Right, Eric.
Hey, Charles, how are you doing?
Great, man. How are you doing? It's been way too long. Now, judging by the sort of glare in here, where are we?
We are in Seattle, in Redmond, or wherever we are, you know, at Microsoft campus.
Right on, man. And thanks for coming by. I like those pillows next to you.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah. We're in the right direction here.
Cool. So, hey, Niners and a lot of people who've watched Channel 9 over the years are curious, what have you been up to? What is Eric Meyer doing these days? That's the first question.
So, well, after many years in the Pacific Northwest, I moved down to Silicon Valley, the mecca of high tech. And I spent, about 18 months there to really absorb the hacker culture and see what, you know, what is that all about. Mm. And I must say, it's amazing. There's nothing like Silicon Valley on this planet.
Okay. So let me ask you a question, because I think that's a wonderful topic.
Yep.
Hacker culture. What is the hacker culture? What is the hacker way? What do you mean?
Well, like a lot of people, when they think about hacking, you know, they think about people doing bad things, and that's a little bit sad. That, you know, I think the media has kind of, you know, used the word hacker in this negative context. Whereas if you look at the origins of the word hacker, you know, you can look up in the Hacker's Dictionary. It's really about people that are trying to kind of, you know, be creative by bending the rules a little bit, by using things in a way that they were not intended to be used for. And with software, that is really easy because, you know, we're using APIs all the time where maybe they were not designed for the purpose that we're using it for, or our programming languages, and we're trying to build things despite those limitations. And so we're using our creativity to create things without kind of, you know, being restricted by the rules. And with software, there's literally very little restriction, right? But in the physical world, this thing, you know, wants to drop down. But with software, we are in control. So I think that's one of the reasons that in software, this culture of creativity has prevailed.
Absolutely. Now, when you were saying that, it occurred to me that if there's one language that I can think of that's been used in ways that it was never intended to be used, that's JavaScript, man. I mean, let's think about that. That's the first thing that popped into my head when you said that. So, interesting. I mean, if you're a JavaScript developer out there, be proud of being a hacker, because you're spending most of your time hacking.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely a great observation. If you look at JavaScript, it was intended for a specific purpose, to kind of write little animations on a web page. But it has been bent in all kind of directions that the original designers never thought about. And for example, you know, JavaScript is now used as an assembly language. People are taking other languages like TypeScript or Dart or OCaml, or like we did with Volta. They are mapping other languages onto JavaScript. And I don't think that, you know, when JavaScript was designed, people had in mind that, you know, it would be a runtime, the universal runtime of the web.
Sure.
And other things in JavaScript were, since it's so flexible, you can bend it in the most, you know, creative ways.
Interesting. I mean, it is kind of, not to spend too much time on JavaScript, but it is sort of interesting that the language was designed for such a domain-specific purpose, but because of how it was designed, it was able to span many different domains. Now, whether or not the designer understood that while he was designing it is one thing, but it's very interesting how that has turned out to be real.
Absolutely.
So, the power of dynamic languages, dude. Now, I don't want to get into that conversation. So, but listen, hacker culture, it's so great to have you here, because I know, I mean, you've always been a hacker. Ever since you first came on Channel 9, first came at Microsoft, you were a hacker, because you would build interesting things. You'd build something called Volta, which still lives today in the form of RX. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. Yes. Right?
And how's Volta doing?
Well, if you look at RX, so one of the things that I tried to do, one of the goals when I left Microsoft, was to take RX and move it beyond .NET. So it started out with RX.NET, and we originally shipped in the Windows Phone. I see a beautiful yellow Nokia phone sitting on your desk there. So that was the first place we shipped it. I guess it's still in the ROM of every Windows Phone. Mm-hmm. And we developed RX for JavaScript that was used by Netflix, is still used by Netflix. But the whole point of RX is that its value increases with the number of implementations that you have. For example, let's take Netflix as an example. They run RX in their UI, but also they have RX Java on the server. And now you can send RX event streams between client and server. And so what my goal is to put RX in every programming language on every platform. And I think we achieved that. Like within Microsoft, Kirk Skoop has been doing fantastic work on RX for C++. The folks at GitHub have done tremendous work on RX for iOS, for Objective-C, and so it's now everywhere. So you can use it across any device, any operating system, any programming language. It's there for PHP, for JavaScript, you name it, you can use RX. Excellent. And so now you can connect every system by sending asynchronous event streams between them. And so I'm pretty happy about that. I've been spending a lot of time with Ben Christensen at Netflix to work on RX Java. We are now very close to V1 for that. And RX Java is not only RX Java, but there's on the JVM, which is kind of interesting. The JVM has actually turned into a common language runtime. I think there are more languages running on the JVM than on the CLR. And for example, there's Clojure, there's Scala, there's Groovy, JRuby, and all these languages are also supported. There are RX bindings for them.
Absolutely.
So that has been super exciting.
Great. So it's interesting because RX in .NET world is where it began, right?
Yep, that's where it began, yeah.
And it's... You know, RX is still being used in .NET world internally at Microsoft. In fact, Cortana is heavily
absolutely
reliant
yes.
upon Cortana about RX.
Yep. So whenever you ask something Cortana something, it will generate an RX query. Mm-hmm. And so yes, it definitely works like that. And a lot of the people that were involved with the original RX work are working on Cortana, Bartosz Matt, you
yep.
have kind of interviewed him.
Yes.
Savas is working on it. So, yeah, I'm really happy to see that the Bing team, you know, can leverage RX for such an amazing product.
Absolutely. Now, the last time people saw you on Channel 9, it was during your keynote at lang.next 2014.
Yes.
And that generated a bunch of excitement.
That was a very interesting reaction, yes.
So, you know, and it was a really great talk. I recommend everyone go watch that if you haven't seen that.
The nice thing about that talk is when we were working on RX Java, we came up with a completely different implementation, much more efficient implementation. So that talk at lang.next mm-hmm. explains the kind of fundamentals of that approach.
Okay.
But that was not what kind of caused all the excitement, I guess.
No, not at all. It was sort of your colored commentary, which I think is fine. I mean, I think it's wonderful to be able to have, you know, being so invested in Channel 9, honesty is much more important than anything else.
Yep.
You mix honesty and passion, and it can't go wrong. So technically, though, your talk was also extraordinarily interesting because your premise and your what I took away from it at the highest level was to stop thinking in terms of reactivity, right? And reactive. You were saying things like the death of reactive, and you were explaining what it all really means. Now that might have been, I don't know.
Yeah. So here's one thing that which I think our industry suffers from is that we like to use buzzwords. For example, agile. If you read the Agile Manifesto, the original Agile Manifesto, it's one page, you know, very short. And now, if you look at Scrum and all this stuff, it has turned into something that's kind of the complete opposite of what I think, in my opinion, the Agile Manifesto was trying to promote. And the same with reactive. I think the word, you know, we're introducing this word and then it becomes meaningless. And what I'm always trying to do is I'm trying to go to the essence of something. And for me, the essence is always, you know, mathematics. And so what I was trying to say in this talk is that, you know, we shouldn't get carried away with buzzwords. Mm. And this is not only for reactive, it's for everything. Functional programming. Everybody is talking about functional programming. And I don't know what it is in our industry. All we should do is write code. And it doesn't matter how you call it. We are hackers. We write code. And I think when you start to try to give it names, you're moving away from the core of what we're doing. Because if you're a real hacker, you want to get your work done. It doesn't matter. I write in Haskell one day, and then the same day I write in PHP or in Dart, because you have to get your job done. You should not get attached to a certain technology. Once you feel that, you know that you're on the wrong path. So that is what I was trying to convey at that talk.
So the thing that's interesting there, and I mean, I've had many conversations over the years on Channel 9, and one of them was with Herb Sutter, and he talked about, and I believe you were even at this interview, but the conversation was about use the right tool for the job. Don't always rely on one language to do everything, which is a bit ironic since he works on C++.
Is the Swiss Army knife.
It's the Swiss Army knife for native programming, very capable, yes. Very powerful language, and still basically powers most of the Earth's computing infrastructure.
Yep.
So that said, I mean, that's arguable. You could say C, but the moral of the story I find it interesting, though, because as hackers, and even I'm hacking these days, people probably don't even know what I'm up to anymore, but you have to get your job done. And you don't always have the ability to just program in whatever language you need to get a specific task done. Because ultimately, the work cut that would come out, you know, basically, how do you mix the stuff you've done in Haskell with the stuff you've done in C#? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but let me give you an example. So I often have people come to me and say, oh, Eric, you know, I would love to use Haskell in my work, but I cannot, and I'm frustrated about that. That's the wrong attitude.
Okay.
Because you can write Haskell, or the kind of, you know, the ideas, you can use the ideas of Haskell and functional programming in any language. At the moment that you restrict yourself to say, you think I have to use Haskell to do that, you're limiting your world. Let me give you an example. Say you're going camping,
okay,
and you need to make a fire, but you know your matchbox got wet. Now you can get in panic and say, oh, I don't know how to make fire because I cannot use my matches. Well, you will die. So what do you do? You make fire in a different way, because the real goal is to make fire. The goal is not to use matches. Mm. And that is the thing you keep in mind. We're solving an engineering problem, and we use whatever means we can find to do that. And if this is not available to you, you use something else. That's the whole beauty of building things. Is that, you know, you use your creativity to kind of, you know, work around these limitations.
Excellent. One of the things I've been working on lately is sort of quality kind of quality engineering and understanding, you know, how to
okay.
Yeah. So how to write quality code. So it's one thing to hack code. And so and that's it's another thing to hack quality code. So hack is still there. So you can hack code or you can hack quality
okay,
code.
Okay, so I'm strongly disagreeing with you here.
Well, because I can't win this argument then.
No, that's fine. Because when people think, again, when people hear I'm hacking code, you often think, you know, so there's the kind of negative connotation of breaking in and kind of trying to steal things or...
Sure.
But there's also like, you know, hacking as if, you know, you're doing like a shitty job. You're kind of just putting something together without much thought. Mm. But that, I think, misses the essence of hacking. When you're hacking something, you want to find an elegant and beautiful solution. So that is part of hacking. So hacking and quality, it's an oxymoron. Not an oxymoron.
The dual of oxymoron.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
The okay. dual of oxymoron.
Right on.
So like hacking implies quality.
Interesting.
So, yes.
So I would say, judging by some of the frameworks and APIs that I've seen, and these are not just things I've seen, you know, at some company X, but even out on the net to go grab.
I think it's called, isn't that called pleonasm? Is that the dual of oxymoron?
That's a great one. That's an exercise for the viewers. What is the dual of oxymoron? It has to be the mathematical dual, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So.
Okay, you're talking about quality hacking.
I am talking about quality hacking, and I don't mean in any way. I mean, but I also at some point we need to talk about hacker culture because I've had the pleasure of reviewing one of your latest papers that haven't been released
yep.
yet, which I think is a brilliant way. And a lot of middle management and CEOs need to read this for sure. And I hope that you get to release this soon.
Yep.
So I definitely want to talk about hacker culture and the importance of hacker culture in modern business. But in terms of quality, you know, I'm seeing in reality that when you have to get something done, we have to ship this app by August 1st to meet a specific deadline of another customer, or most importantly, all of our customers, because it happens to fall on a date
yep.
that really matters. The football season starting, for example. We have to get this done. And so, to use one of the terms you don't like to use, sort of the waterfall model of development versus agile, where you write a bunch of stuff, add a bunch of features, and then send it over to a test team that then bang on it and send you a bunch of bugs back, and you scratch your head and go, oh crud,
yep.
maybe we shouldn't have designed it this way. That's actually a really bad bug. And then by the end of the time, you don't make the August 1st deadline. That's what I'm trying to get to. The more agile quality would be quality first hacking, where quality is the first thing in your mind. All the code you write doesn't need to be unit tested because it's that good. Now that's naive and no one really can probably get away with that, but why can't that type of thinking be part of the hacker culture?
And what I was trying to say is that it is.
Okay.
It definitely is. I mean, if you envision a great hacker, that is somebody that can do amazing things that are efficient, correct, maintainable, so that have all the kind of, you know, qualities that you're looking for. And maybe this might be a little bit controversial, but I think in our field, we are not professional enough. And let me make the analogy with the medical field. Say that, you know, you are a surgeon and you are operating a patient. Now you have a very strict deadline too, because this patient might be losing blood. So if you don't finish your job, you know, within, you know, X hours, the patient will die. So it's the same kind of deadline that you have with software. But you're still kind of, you know, not doing a shitty job. You're not, you want to kind of, you know, do a quality job on operating this patient. You're not just kind of, you know, just sewing this thing together and hacking, slapping some duct tape on it, and like, done, next one. So you see, and this is the kind of thing, is that, you know, software development is it's a profession, and it takes a long time to become proficient. You cannot just take, you know, whatever book, you know, learn programming in 24 hours and think that you can become a developer. So it is the same as any other field, like musicians, surgeons, any professional. And I think our field needs much more professionals. And I think, and the whole idea that people think that coding is easy, but you know, look at elementary school. You know, it takes all of elementary school to learn elementary calculations. You know, addition, multiplication, whatever. Coding is much more difficult than that. You don't learn coding in a weekend. Mm-hmm. It takes many years of practice, of hard study. You know, it's an academic discipline.
Sure.
And then you get the quality. But think of if you're a developer, think like you're a surgeon. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to. There's a deadline, and you want to do the best possible job that you can do because you want the patient to survive.
Absolutely.
And live on for a long time, like your software.
Yes.
And sometimes you create throwaway software, but then you must know what you're doing really well, because often mm-hmm. you think you're creating throwaway software, but then it turns out to be used in the long run.
Yes.
So it's all about this, you know, the ability to see through these things.
I agree. And I do think quality is too associated with the test discipline, and it needs to be more associated with the act of hacking and the act of thinking about writing code. It should be in the forefront of your mind, just like writing secure code, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not,
write secure code, man, because you're going to end up hurting the person on the other end, the person, the human on the other end of your code. You should always remember what's on the other end of your code. It's generally a human.
That's most of the time rewrite code to aid humans. That's I think a very good thing to look for, because there's a lot of software and a lot of websites that absolutely kind of drive you crazy. That are not, I wonder whether the people that built these things ever use it themselves. I mean, or maybe they did, and then they kind of quit the field or something. I don't know. They kind of now pack bags at Fred Meyer or something like that, because it's just so bad. Mm. And the whole goal of software is to automate the boring parts of what we do. Mm. Right, so it's that we as humans can use our intellect to do interesting things.
Like post videos on Facebook.
Of cats, yes.
So, excellent. You know, I should have probably nominated you for the Ice Bucket Challenge, but I didn't know where you were. But we'll move on by that. So, I thought that was a good cause and a very good use of social engineering. So I want to step back and ask you, in terms of, you know, we haven't had a Channel 9 interview like this for, you've been what, 3 years now? 4 years? 3 years? 2 years? Years just fly by. I don't know anymore.
Oh, yeah. No. It's about 18 months that I kind of left the
happy Death Star. With
and the beautiful weather. It's amazing. You know, there's, yes. I see blue sky, which is,
Totally. I think you'd be impressed because, you know, one of the things that's really cool about Microsoft right now, both of us having been here for a long time, I'm still here, is that Satya really is driving this notion of sort of a hack-first mentality. Like, you hear cloud-first, whatever, my favorite thing that he talks about is ambient intelligence and ubiquitous computing, right? So this sort of hacker culture that's important for everyone to have, is something we're starting to see start to creep into the culture of Microsoft. And it mixes a little bit like oil and water with some of the older models that are going on, but just so you know, it's nice to see that things are starting to make progress in the area that you're discussing.
When I look from the outside what Satya is doing, this guy is my hero. I mean, it's amazing because I love Microsoft. Okay, I love Microsoft. And in order to compete with the companies in Silicon Valley, Microsoft had to change. It has to embrace the kind of more hacker culture and the kind of developer culture. And this is one of the things that was, that caused the kind of ripples when I gave the talk at Lang.next. Because the thing is, like, if you look at the companies in Silicon Valley, the ratio between people that write code and people that talk about code is completely different. So you have to change that. If you're a software company, it should all be about writing software. So like that's one of the things, is like, you know, you should create the circumstances where developers, the only thing that the developer has to think about is writing code, writing quality code. You should take away all other distractions. There should be no meetings, no stand-ups. Developers should be focused on writing code. And the goal of management is to create that context where developers can focus on code. And you know, now that you're hacking as well, Charles, you know, you're writing code, you're kind of deep into, maybe you're debugging, you have your stack trace here on the left, you're kind of inspecting everything, mm-hmm. and then suddenly, you know, an interruption happens.
Yeah.
And now your mental stack just completely collapses, and then it takes you half an hour to get back, you know, to build up the mental state mm-hmm. to continue. So that's why it's so important that, you know, developers can just focus on development. And management goal, the only goal of management should be to keep developers happy. And the other thing, which might also be controversial, is to make sure that there's a context that the developers know exactly what they should optimize for. And the problem with software is that it's too flexible, it's soft, right? So if you don't give a developer a very, very clear goal, there's just too many dimensions he can wander off into. An analogy I like to use is music. Mm. Some people think that improvised music, like jazz music, that people just kind of go and play whatever they want. That's not the case. If people would just play whatever they want, the music would be awful. Okay? So instead what happens is you decide what key you're playing in, what beat you're playing in, and so within that context, which is a very restricted context, then you have complete freedom. And that's when you get, you know, beauty. Or the same with painting. You know, you pick the size of your canvas, you pick what materials you want to use, oil paint or, you know, whatever. And then, you know, within those constraints, that's when you develop. So I think that's super important that developers know exactly what they should optimize for. So should they optimize for performance? Should they optimize for maintainability? Or so, because otherwise, you know, that's why projects run over time, because developers have too much freedom.
Interesting. So I was toward the end, I was thinking in terms of, because I do a lot of work now with designers.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, the way I look at it is, a design is, well, this is what design is. Design is solving problems for people.
Yes.
That's what design means. It doesn't necessarily mean making colors on a web page. So,
absolutely.
Solving problems for people. Developers are people. And the people who build APIs for these people are also developers, one would hope. Why is there such a impedance mismatch between, like, useful APIs that are actually easy to use and well-designed and well-thought-out, just like a well-designed experience when using an application? Why isn't that same design mentality in place for many APIs, APIs in general? That gets into the topic of quality still, but more of an API design quality.
Absolutely. So one of the things is that I think the fact that software is so abstract is one of the difficulty there. When you think about design of real things, I mean, the design, I don't know if people can see it. Let me move this chair over here. The design of this doorknob, okay? Somebody has designed this, you know, you see this curve here mm-hmm. and so on. But, you know, it's obvious when you look at this because you can see it, you can feel it, you can touch it. But with software, you know, an API, which this is an API for operating the door, okay, but it's a physical thing. An API is, you know, it's something to operate code. So we should kind of design it in the same way that we design physical things. Now, one of the things with design, and again, I'm going back to the constraints, when you design this, you're putting a lot of constraints. I mean, I'm not going to put like, you know, diamonds on here and, you know, whatever. No, you're trying to kind of, you know, make this thing such that it can open the door and open the door only. Okay, I don't want to, maybe I have a bottle opener on this thing. Because, you know, on Friday when it's beer bash time, I want to open my bottle. That would not be a good doorknob.
Mm.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you have to constrain yourself when you design something to make it do the thing you want it to do, and just do that and do it in the most beautiful and elegant way possible.
Okay.
And the same applies for APIs. And so when you design an API, you should make it minimal. It must do just what it's supposed to do. But because people don't see designing an API in the same way as they see designing everyday things or designing UIs, again, and I don't want to be controversial, but then a lot of people that have no design skills will design APIs because they don't see it as designs. So those people will never even dream of designing a doorknob, right? So we should be very careful. So design of APIs is a discipline and it requires talent. Just like not everybody can play the violin,
mm-hmm.
not everybody or should play the violin. I mean, if I play the violin, I will never play the violin. I mean, it would drive everybody crazy.
Interesting.
So I know that. And so I think people should realize that designing an API is design and that it requires a certain skills that you can either train or that you have because you have some sense of beauty, and then that's what you should do.
Excellent.
But it's interesting that you mentioned it because I've been saying this for a long time that we should treat the API design just like any other form of design.
Great. And I, as one of the consumers of these designs, I have to beg and plead that that be done.
Exactly.
So how do we, in a pragmatic way, how can you, you know, I can always spot a designer who's like a UX designer or a UI designer or an interactive designer because typically they're wearing black glasses and black shirt. Just joking, my friends. but what I'm really trying to say is there is no, my name is Charles and I'm an API designer. Like I usually just hear, you know, hey, my name is Frank and I'm a dev and I built this public API for you to use and I'm not a designer. Like they'll actually say, I'm not a designer because I don't think they understand that designer just doesn't mean colors, right?
Exactly.
So
somehow our industry should realize that API design is an important topic and that it is design, just like it's designing, you know, doorknobs.
Cool.
And I think, you know, And people know when an API is well designed, and there's also, and we're just like for designing physical things, for API design, people have design guidelines. You know, if you're designing an API, make sure that it follows these rules.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that has to do with restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
If the API is designed in a way that's recognizable. Now, you know, you don't have to relearn the things all the time. You know, there's a certain pattern.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain pattern that worked well in the past, and so we codify that as design guidelines.
Great.
So even, you know, if you're not a designer, if you're not a designer, then you should even more follow the design guidelines.
I agree. Now, with all due respect, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Christoph Qualina. He's still at Microsoft. He's working on some team. And he wrote the canonical .NET Design Guidelines book.
Yeah.
And so my feeling is that if you build an API that requires a book to explain how to use it, or how to think through designing your own APIs that target the same underlying system, the CLR .NET framework, right? Naively, I would say there's probably an interesting design question there in that it's a bit too complex. To make a long story short, I've had a conversation with Christoph, and it turns out in 2008, he took his whole book And he condensed it down to 9 pages of do this, don't do that, consider doing this. And that's when I saw that, I had this brand new respect for design, the .NET design guidelines, because that's all I needed. I only needed 9 pages. That's all a typical human would need. We don't need to read a book. So when do you know, what are some telltale signs that the API may be poorly designed?
Okay, no, so, but what you're describing here, there's several interesting aspects here. The one thing is that it's always easier to write a thick book than to write something concise, right? We all know this. There's many quotes about that, you know, something is finished when there's nothing left to take away, blah, blah, blah. So it's way easier to write a 500-page book than to write those 10 pages. And this is another fantastic example. But on the other hand, again, if we're taking API design seriously, people study industrial design. I mean, it's a university study. It takes 3 years or whatever to get your master's in industrial design. Okay, so I would say if we want to educate API designers, I don't mind if they kind of study several years to kind of get that. And if you're doing industrial design, you will read many books and many books of hundreds of pages. So if you're designing an API, you should read many books, you should study many other APIs. So there's no way around that. So there's no shortcuts.
Okay.
And again, it's just like playing music. If you're playing the guitar, do you play?
I play the bass.
You play the bass. Play the bass.
I know. We never had a jam session.
Yes.
I want a band with two basses and a French horn.
Yeah, but you know what do you do? You listen to other bass players. What they do? Do you like it? Don't you like it? You play your riffs. You know, you practice. That has all to do with being a professional. And the same should hold for API designers. So,
absolutely.
So I don't mind having a 200-page book.
To read as a API consumer?
Not as an API consumer, as an API designer.
Right on. So my perspective was coming from just wanting to read what the guidelines were in less than 200 or 300 pages.
Yeah, yeah. No, the thing is, like, you know, I think it's good to have like a short version for the consumers of the API, but to kind of set your expectations and so on.
So now you're a part-time professor these days.
Yeah,
I think you can call it that, or I don't think that's the official term, but you're an adjunct professor at the University of Delft.
Yep.
In the beautiful Netherlands. Are there any API design classes at the University of Delft Computer Science Department?
Currently, they're not, but Delft has a very well-respected and great industrial design department. And if I look at kind of, you know, how the students are trained there to kind of design things, I think we're way, way behind in computer science in that same respect. Because again, it's like, you know, software is taking over the world, and so designing things. So it's not only designing APIs for developers, but it's also designing what is a UI. In some sense, that's an API as well for regular users to use the computer.
Sure.
And so I think we can learn an awful lot from industrial design, from physical things, from designing physical things in our virtual world, But look at this, Charles. Our industry is very young. I mean, when Fortran, 1957. Okay, so and that was just before I was born.
Okay,
and there's many of the pioneers. Some of them have kind of, you know, died recently, but there's still a lot of people that were kind of, you know, the pioneers of our field. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that we're still learning, mm-hmm. And this field is growing really, really fast. So we're kind of, you know, running behind the facts a little bit. But I'm super optimistic. But I bet you, mm-hmm. 10 years from now, people will study. Maybe I should kind of retract my words here, because the question is, mm-hmm. how many API designers does the world need? Yeah, so it, like, if you look at industrial design, you know, you kind of, you know, how many people do you educate each year world round? You know, I don't know, maybe say 50,000, I'm just making a guess.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need 50,000 API designers? Maybe not. So, but it could be that you have like a postgraduate course in API design. And let's not only talk about API design, there's also language design.
Yes.
Because languages are the tools that developers use to program computers.
Mm-hmm.
And language design is another kind of, you know, special skill. And that also requires, like Anders is like a master in that thing. To kind of, you know, it maybe it's because like all the great Danish design, you know, like, which is also super beautiful and minimalistic.
Yeah.
But it's a special skill, and not everybody can design languages.
Sure. And he dresses like a designer. Like he has the short glasses, the styly clothes. I mean, Anders
like
can be a designer.
He looks like a bum.
You don't look like a bum. You look more like a hacker.
Yeah.
So that's great. I think it would be wonderful for people taking computer science classes as part of that curriculum to take a design class, whether it be industrial, mechanical, whatever. Just get a sense of whether or not they can kind of grok.
Yes,
what that means.
And even if you're not designing an API for external consumption,
yeah,
you're still designing the structure of your code.
Yes.
You're designing, you know, and depending on, again, on what are the real goals of your code,
mm-hmm,
you know, that design might change. Because if you're, say you're designing a data structure, right, you have to know, is this thing got mostly read or is it mostly right?
Mm.
And depending on that, you will give it a different design.
Sure.
So you have to be very aware of these things, design skills. And they kind of apply at every level of abstraction.
Right on. So back at the University of Delft, you're teaching a course in functional programming. What exactly are you doing now these days? I know you're going to be doing another course.
Yes, so I'm doing this fall, I'm actually doing on edX, I'm doing a version of the Channel 9 lectures, functional programming lectures, but now as a MOOC.
Okay.
And
massively online,
massive
orchestrated
open online
chaos
course.
Okay.
The funny thing is, if you read when we kind of came up with that idea long time ago, what was it, 2009 or 2007?
Something like that.
2007.
Yeah, 2007.
Yeah. Our goal,
mm-hmm,
was to kind of have like, you know, these courses online with Channel 9.
Yep.
And now suddenly these MOOCs are all over the place. So Charles, we should have kind of, you know, at that point we should have done a startup to kind of do MOOCs.
Agreed, man. Agreed.
But anyway, so this course will be based on the same book, so Graham Hutton's book.
Okay.
The big difference is that it will come with exercises and homework,
mm,
and you can get a certificate.
Great.
So it's like the Channel 9 lectures were more kind of free form to kind of, you know, teach you functional programming. Here it's really kind of more like a course.
Understood.
A real course. So there's exercises, homework, you program.
Mm.
But again, it's not about programming in Haskell. It's about learning to use functional programming. So my motto here is think like a fundamentalist, code like a hacker. So I don't want people to get frustrated. Oh, at work I cannot use Haskell. No, who cares? If you use assembly language at work and you have taken this course, you can apply the principles of designing code when you write assembly language.
Okay.
So in some sense, maybe this is an interesting kind of, you know, twist to the
Great.
Whole interview. Functional programming is a lot about designing the way your code looks like. And you don't need Haskell to do that. Because once you have these design rules, these design principles, you can apply them everywhere. And I think that's the real strength of this idea.
Interesting. I think the interesting thing, though, is when you find examples of... So when you give the exercises in this MOOC...
Yeah.
Are the exercises going to be language neutral?
The exercises are as language neutral as we can get. Because so here's one of the challenges of running a MOOC. And
okay.
That's why, you know, when we did the
Besides the name, okay.
Yeah, besides the name. But when we did the Channel 9 lectures, we thought about that, but a lot of these things are still not solved. Mm-hmm. So right now, I think about roughly 20,000 people will have signed up by the time we start, which means that, you know, you cannot grade 20,000 exercises by hand.
Of course.
Now, so how do you kind of, you know, build a system where you can grade these things? Well, that's impossible. Mm. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to give the programming exercises in such a way that you can use whatever language you want, and that also fits in this philosophy of, you know, think like a fundamentalist but code like a hacker.
Okay.
And then the exercises will be graded in like Project Euler style. So we won't look at your style or whatever, we'll just give you a unit test, and then, you know, that you have to pass the unit tests. And I think it's still an open problem, for example, to do automatic kind of style checking of code. Mm. You know, we all love Visual Studio or IntelliJ or ReSharper, but most of the kind of tools that, like AvexCop, that check your code, check on syntactic things. They don't kind of see if you're using the right style. That's why we do code reviews. Mm-hmm. Right? That's why we're doing human code reviews, because that's something that's very hard to automate. So that's one part. So those are the programming exercises. And then we have multiple choice questions. And most of them will be based on Haskell, because they're based on the book. But again, I will not ask you specific Haskell things. It's really about kind of, you know, taking this spirit of functional programming. And so I will do the best I can to kind of decouple this course from Haskell. Haskell is just a vehicle, it's not the goal.
Understood.
But you have to pick a language, and Haskell happens to be a language that has very low syntactic noise. You cannot cheat because it's pure, so it's a really good language to teach these things.
Mm. And so how do you take the concept of purity and apply it to a language that's fundamentally impure by design, because it's all about generating side effects? That's the whole reason of using the language in the first place and the tools underneath it. And so how do you take the concepts of anytime you want to create a side effect, you use a monad or whatever, to accomplish that. How do you take that sort of concept and stick it onto Java?
Okay, so good question.
So
for me, maybe the analogy is like riding a bike with training wheels. So monads are like training wheels. You know, you whenever you try to go beyond the effects that you specify in a monad, you will be slapped on the wrist, because the type checker will say, you know, Charles, you're trying to do I/O, but you're only allowed to mutate state. Okay, and so that's like training wheels.
Sure.
Yeah. But the goal is not to kind of, you know, have a particular monad. The goal is to be mindful of the fact that you have side effects. Once you have that mindfulness, it doesn't matter when you go to Java, because it's here. The monad is here. And Java may not kind of, you know, slap you on the wrist, you know, when you're kind of moving outside the monad. Mm-hmm. But again, if you're a great hacker, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter. I can make fire with, you know, two sticks and a rope. Mm-hmm. I don't need my matches.
Okay.
And so that's the thing. I don't need monads to kind of be mindful about effects. Then on the other side, on the plus side, sometimes having the training wheels can also be distracting, because maybe I have to ride my cycle through the mud. I have to do dirty things, and then these training wheels are just getting stuck in the mud. Mm. So I'm better off to kind of, you know, have no training wheels, to go through this muddy path, and then, you know, I go back onto the regular road.
I see.
So yes, it's really about mindfulness.
Great. I like it. Thinking, right?
Thinking.
Right?
Yeah.
Think functionally, act statically, or act imperatively. Or
no.
How would you say it?
I say think like a fundamentalist, code like a hacker.
Right on. So let's talk a little bit, since we have you,
yeah.
You know, obviously people have been wanting to hear from you. Some of the interesting things you've been working on with Applied Duality, which is your company.
Yep.
We don't have to talk about specific customers of yours, but what are some interesting technical problems you've been solving?
So as I said, one of the things I've been doing is to kind of, you know, venture beyond the .NET world into, you know, for example, the Java ecosystem, all the languages that are there. Mm. Yeah, moving from Windows to Mac, and so on, and I think, in terms, if you think again about problem solving, you know, in order to solve a problem, if you look at the real world, you know, typically it's heterogeneous. You have to kind of, you know, use many things to tie things together. Sometimes you don't have a choice, you know. So I can be on Azure. I love Azure. But maybe there's some legacy code that I need to access that's on an IBM mainframe. And then I cannot say, oh, sorry, guys, I cannot take this project because that's not doesn't run on Azure. No, you have to fix it.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of, you know, the thing that I did appreciate is that there's a whole world out there of all kind of other things that I worked with. I must say the Java language is light years behind C sharp. Light years behind.
It has C-sharp. Lambdas now.
It has
it
lambdas.
It didn't even
now.
Get lambdas before C++
so
did.
When did Church invent lambda calculus? Like, what is it, 1950 or something? It's about time that Java has lambdas.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, you know, the JVM ecosystem is extremely vibrant. And I would love to see that kind of same, like the open source community that exists in the Java world, mm-hmm. also kind of, you know, happen on in the .NET world. And one of the great things, I've been using a lot of Mono. So in the past year, whenever I write C sharp, I use Mono. I think these guys did a fantastic job to take the beauty and the productivity of C sharp and bring that to other platforms. You know, if you want to write an iOS app, you should be able to do that in C sharp. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the Xamarin guys have done, you know, amazing work. I mean, kudos to them. Mm-hmm. And also thanks to them, I can still use C sharp when I use my Mac.
Awesome.
So this has been great. So that has been an interesting journey. One thing that really surprised me is when I was a young Eric, I used VI. Some people use Emacs. I am on the VI side. But then, you know, now I'm using IDEs. So I used to use VI, but now I use IntelliJ or Visual Studio or Xamarin Studio. But what surprises me is that a lot of the young developers are using Vim. So it was like being kind of, you know, projected back in time 30 years.
Interesting. So and why is that? Like what do you think is behind that? The simplicity versus the overbearing complexity of a modern IDE? Or
I really don't know. I'm puzzled by it.
Okay.
Because the thing is, like, you know, when you're We're still, which is another thing that puzzles me. And again, I don't want to kind of insult anybody, but if you look at how we deal with a lot of software things, like a spreadsheet, okay? A spreadsheet has a special editor to edit the spreadsheet, and we're treating the spreadsheet as an abstract thing. But with code, somehow we're still treating code as text. And maybe it's because of that. Whereas once you're used to the IDE, you don't see code as text anymore. And sometimes when you talk to the Smalltalk people, they say there wasn't even surface syntax for Smalltalk. It's just something that lives in your image. And this is the thing that you know, like software or code is really not text. It has structure. And somehow we're not using that. We're not leveraging the fact that code has structure. And But you know, if you're treating code as text, then you know text editors like Emacs or Vim, you know, are super useful.
Sure.
But the thing is, like, you know, when I want to find a method, I don't want to find it by text. I want to find the method, you know, based on whatever the compiler resolves the method to.
Exactly.
And I want to find it.
Totally, man. I mean, it's either being productive or, I mean, some people can write wonderful code in Notepad, right? Or TextPad++, whatever. And that's great. But it's really, really a wonderful thing to be able to right-click on an interface and say, write all the stub implementations, like things that I have to implement for it, which is what I love. I mean, a huge shout-out to JetBrains. I love those geniuses, man.
Yeah, exactly. But this is, again, I think it also kind of, you know, shows that our industry is still young.
Very young.
It's still very young. So that is one thing. Then the other thing, and we talked about this, is like I've been super interested in the culture. I worked with many, many different companies since I left Microsoft,
mm-hmm.
and it's very interesting to see the culture. You see, the influence of the founders is amazing. So I think, you know. By the way, if people want to kind of, you know, get like an informal introduction to the hacker's way,
mm-hmm.
they should read Mark Zuckerberg's letter when Facebook IPO'd,
mm-hmm.
where he explains the hacker way. They should read the hacker's dictionary, mm-hmm. and go back to the original sources, you know, the Berkeley, MIT. So the culture has been kind of, you know, quite amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking quite a lot about, you know, like how did I run my team here at Microsoft? What do I like about the various companies, the cultures that I've seen there?
Mm-hmm.
And the paper that you mentioned in the beginning, that's trying to distill those ideas into a form that, you know, that I can communicate to others.
Great.
And one thing that also that I'm trying to do there is that more than ever I'm convinced that software is changing the world. That the software is the real thing that drives economic growth. And my favorite example at this moment is Uber. Have you used Uber? Do you have Uber
have
on your phone?
I don't have it on my phone.
Okay. So I don't use Uber, I don't use any kind of regular taxi service anymore. So with Uber, you know, you have your app,
mm-hmm.
you know, that has a little map where you see all the kind of cars,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, if you need a car, you click, the closest car will come, you go in there, you don't have to pay, well, you have to pay, but you don't have to kind of, you know, hassle with cash,
mm-hmm.
And your credit card is in there, you get, you know, the minute you leave the car, you already have the email with your receipt that you can give to your accountant.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that one time that we were in LA, that we went for dinner at one of the PDCs?
Yes, I do.
And then on the way back, we took a cab, and since we had to pay with credit card for our expense reports,
yeah.
But this guy refused to take a credit card, and you even said, I'd pay you more if you take a card, and
yeah.
The guy, all those things don't exist with Uber.
Great.
Now the other great thing with Uber is they know exactly what the kind of real-time situations is of the cars,
mm.
so they can adjust the prices.
Mm.
Or they know where they should send their cars because they know where the demand is. And I think in a few years, the other thing is that Uber, they don't own their fleet, okay? These are private people that kind of work for Uber with their car. So really all that Uber has is the software and the data.
Mm.
Okay, so it's completely a software company. So when you think of a taxi company, you think of a company that runs cars.
Mm-hmm.
Uber is a taxi company that has no cars, only software and algorithms. Okay, and the next thing that what will happen is that poor drivers, they will be replaced by self-driving cars, which are also software driven. So, you know, 5 years from now, you will click on your Uber and this kind of, you know, little drone, whatever comes in and you step in and it will bring you to your destination. So it will be totally software driven. And people, so companies need to embrace this fact that software is their most important asset. And so everything is driven by software. Now the thing what you can learn from that is that you also should kind of, you know, run your company in a kind of software driven way. And one of the theories that I'm kind of trying to develop is that you have to model a company as a feedback loop where you learn from the environment. So like, you know, the company's goal is to take the input from the environment, do something with it and produce output, you know, products or whatever. Now, if you just kind of, you know, produce output without listening to the input or without feedback, you know, you can never improve. If you look at companies like Amazon and Facebook, they are doing A/B testing, you know, all the time. So, you know, they put like this.
Speaking of which,
they put, you know, certain parts of the web page here, they move it around a little bit, and they measure immediately the feedback when people kind of, you know, buy more. So they are kind of, you know, real-time reactive to the customer. Whereas if you look at kind of, you know, like a before software, you know, you would generate the books every quarter or every year, and now the feedback loop is way too slow. So you should also use software to optimize your company. And we should be doing these experiments all the time. And this is another thing, is that when you make these experiments, you have to allow yourself to fail. Because, you know, if I'm putting this part of the web page here and that part of the web page there, there's a chance that, you know, one of them is wrong, that it will actually generate less customers. So in the old days, people would say, oh, that's too much risk, we cannot risk losing customers. But in order to win, you have to lose. So this idea of being able to take a risk, make mistakes, and then roll back quickly is super important. Another example is like with Netflix, when they run on the public cloud. But if you want to make sure that your developers write software that is resistant to failure, what do? You're going to introduce artificial failures. Okay, because in the real world, failures can happen, so you might as well just generate failures artificially to make sure that, you know, you're prepared for this. Well, I think a traditional manager would immediately get seizures when you would say, you know, I'm going to kind of go to your data center and pull out, you know, a couple of power supplies to kind of check whether this software is failure resilient. But you have to do that. If you're running a kind of, you know, cloud-based software, you're pushing out changes many times a day. Like we all remember Windows 95, you know, start me up.
Yeah.
That was a huge thing. Now Facebook, you know, ships new versions of their software multiple times a day. They're not having the Rolling Stones, you know, play a concert every time. No, it just kind of goes all the time. And if something goes wrong, they immediately roll it back. So that is the kind of, if you're talking about agility, that's the agility. It's shipping software is not something kind of, exciting anymore. It's just something that happens, like, all the time.
Let's go to the conclusion of your paper.
Okay.
And what are the, give me like a quick recipe. If I want to start a company, right?
Yep.
Okay. What should I think about in terms of, because I can't just have a company, or can I have a company of just developers?
So here's, I don't think you can have a company of just developers. and there's many kind of, you know, subtle reasons for that. But first of all, what I'm envisioning is actually a quite hierarchical company. So, and the thing I look at is kind of, you know, armies. If you look at armies, they are organizations that have been super successful for thousands of years. And their structure has kind of not changed that much over time. There's very few companies, or I don't know of any company, that has lasted thousands of years. But now if you look at the structure of an army, it's quite hierarchical, where each layer has its kind of, you know, goals. Like, you know, at the highest level there's the kind of, you know, strategy, and then at the lowest level there's the execution, the soldiers that actually kind of, you know, do the work. And so the way I envision, or that I would like to see a software company, is structured along the same lines. Okay. Now, being hierarchical doesn't mean that the people on the floor, the developers, have no power. The whole point of this hierarchy is that you isolate the developers such that all they need to think about is writing code. Okay, so you create the context for the developers where they can be optimally productive, which means that they don't have to worry about, and they don't have to worry about, I need a new screen, and magically the screen appears on their desk, even without them asking. That would be the ideal thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they write code, but the important thing is that they know what code to write and with what goal. And again, to kind of take the analogy with the army, you know, you're not just going to send your soldiers around randomly. No, you know, it's like, okay, we want to kind of, you know, capture that thing, or we have that goal, but within the battle, the soldiers, you know, you cannot command every soldier. They have to kind of make their own decisions. Mm. And that's the same with the developers. The managers are not going to tell the developers, you know, you have to write the semicolons there. The managers have to kind of put the context for the developers and then, you know, give them all the means to, you know, do their job in a good way. And then the other thing is that there has to be a continuous feedback loop at every level, such that the composition, and we talked a lot about compositionality in many of the Channel 9 things,
yeah.
But the company should be compositional. And
okay.
Compositional in some sense also means hierarchical, because when you have a compositional system, you break it up into smaller systems that are composed together. Okay, so there's a clear structure when you talk about a compositional system.
Mm-hmm.
But all these components communicate with each other such that if you look at them as a whole, they are kind of, again, one component. So in my view, at every level, there should be this feedback loop where, you know, you're kind of, you know, looking at the input and the output, and you're feeding back, you're learning from, you know, what you're doing. And if you compose two of these, you know, systems that have internal feedback loops, now you get a new system that has, like, you know, yet another feedback loop, and so on.
Mm.
And everything is driven by software. So that's the other thing. Is I think whenever you make decisions, they should be based on numbers, on data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So again, think about Uber. When they are going to, you know, suggest to their drivers to go to a certain area, it's not because somebody thinks, oh, you know, there's a Dick's kind of, you know, over there, so maybe we should put the drivers there that they can grab a hamburger. That's not data driven. They should put the people, oh, the Seattle Opera is kind of, you know, the performance is closing, so there will be a lot of people that need rides.
Yes.
So that's why they direct this data driven. So everything should be data-driven. It should not be based on seniority. It should not be based on who wears a suit and tie. It should not be based who can scream the loudest,
mm-hmm.
which is also part of the hacker culture. It should be based on the person that has the best data or the best skills to mm-hmm. do that.
Interesting.
And so in that sense, the company, a software-driven company is completely not hierarchical. Okay, because, you know, it's not based on, you know, you decide on either the numbers or on the skills,
mm.
But not on anything else.
Interesting.
So software
as both a product and the lifeblood internally is what will
lead to success.
Because exactly.
Your software will be able to inform you of how your software is being used in the real world. So it's essentially, it's like adding telemetry to the products that you make, so you know if people are using the features, how they're using them. And rather than just pull it out of thin air, wouldn't it be great if you're like, people aren't using this because this happens in this condition.
Yeah. Exactly. And so the other thing, now you have a good thing about features, right? So often people add features and, you know, because whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But do we know the cost of this feature? You know, do we know how many people are using this feature? And so in some sense, if I'm really extreme, also the kind of, you know, people's bonuses should be based on, you know, that data. So if you check in, if you argued really hard for a feature that you kind of, you know, because of some reason, you know, you push through, and now it turns out that that feature is generating 80% of the complaints in the call center, there should be a feedback loop that goes back to you.
It shocks me when I touch my keyboard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But right now, that feedback loop often doesn't exist because, mm-hmm. you know, once you ship your software, it goes into a different part of the organization, and then the effects of your decisions here mm-hmm. don't come back to the source. So that's why this feedback loop is so important.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, when you mentioned, like, it's telemetry, everything is software, but it's also the kind of computational thinking. So you should look at your, when we think about software, we are thinking about instructing a machine. But a company is a machine too, that has to be programmed. And it's not programmed in C# or Java, it's programmed in human language, but still, you know, you have to use the same ideas of programming and optimizing processes and whatever. So using computational thinking to run a company is also important. And there's many, and we know, everybody that works in a company knows that there's a lot of process and a lot of procedures that if you look at them rationally, if you look at them scientifically, they make no sense. They are counterproductive. There's evidence that this thing doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
When we write code and there's evidence that your code has a bug, you're not going to ship that code. You're going to fix that bug. But when we have a process, it can last for many, many years without removing this bug because somebody wanted this process to be in place. And there's no, and there's even, and when there's evidence that that process doesn't work. And so again, this you have to use the same rules that you use to write your software to run your company. And that is why the leaders of a modern company should have a software background. They should be developers themselves, because otherwise you don't understand this mindset. If you have never written code, I think it's very hard to kind of, you know, imagine how a developer thinks,
mm-hmm.
And also then, you know, what the power of software really is.
Right on.
So computational thinking, I think, is the kind of other important aspect there, where, you know, it's like writing software at the next level of abstraction.
Mm. Excellent, man. So hey.
So yes, so I'm kind of turning from, you know, like a hacker, like a code hacker, into, you know.
Well, Satya talks about this term now out there is like growth hacking, like hacking growth. So, and here's a very interesting thing. I was telling you about, instead of having the traditional Microsoft, everybody go to one place and have a big rah-rah session about all this great stuff we're going to try to do in the next fiscal year. We had a week of basically hacking and learning from the key leaders about what's on their mind and stuff like that. And then very few dog and pony shows. And so one of the cool things about the Hackfest that happened this year was that everybody was invited to hack. And that could have been somebody in marketing that had a good idea on how actually to build one of these feedback loops.
Yeah.
They don't have to be developers, but they could hack.
Yep.
A solution. And so hacking can go beyond writing code.
Absolutely.
And it's wonderful that we have a leader that that kind of pushing that down on us.
I'm super happy for Microsoft that, you know.
We miss you though, man. So when you are done on your little field trip, just kidding, you should come back and be a technical leader. So let's connect again in Amsterdam next time I'm there, and maybe I'll have a camera with me again.
All right.
And we can see how you're doing, because I know you're doing a lot of great things. I hear about the high quality work that you're doing for Company Beep and Company Ah, right? And good for you, man. And it sounds like you're hacking like a madman at the code level.
At the code level, and you know, at every level.
Right on.
And so yes, hack on.
Nice to see you again.
Yes, thanks, Charles.
Cheers.